Charles removed his spectacles and wiped them with a large silk handkerchief before replacing them. He took out his pocket watch and consulted it idly, without registering the time of day, or really knowing what he was doing. Shifting his position, he said, "What, then, was your impression of this brilliant llama?" "I must admit to being highly impressed. There is something about him, to my mind, which alters the entire atmosphere." "Yes, I would agree. A sort of magnetism, perhaps. Should one not be a little cautious? There is a feeling of dealing with the unknown." Cecil took a sip of his whiskey and began to feel better. "I shall be extremely interested to see if he really can write." "Cautious," Charles expostulated. "Don't be ridiculous. The man is brilliant. I tell you, he'll write a book which will amaze us all." "Well, not me, of course, because I discovered him in a sense. If you persist in being cautious of what you don't understand, you'll never get anywhere. You'll never understand anything worth understanding. Anyway, the ball, as they say, is in his court now, and yours too. I've done my bit. If nothing comes of it, I shall be, let us truthfully say, extremely disappointed. We must just wait and see, and in the meantime, I have good progress to report to you on the second book, and I hope you have good reports for me on sales of the first." And so they discussed business, touching base on all those matters important and not so important that have to do with books and publishing and earnings. And when it was time for him to go, Charles shook hands and promised to deliver a completed manuscript within 4 months. As he reached the door, he turned round. "Incidentally, Banks, you should get rid of that lift man. Gives a damned poor impression." He disappeared, Macintosh over his arm, fully intending to take the stairs to the ground floor. "It seems to me, so far as I can remember, that we did not see Dr. Guin after Mrs. Wood left until the day he arrived quite unexpectedly to show us the synopsis. It would be a matter of a month or so. Around that time there was a really heavy load of social obligations which left one feeling ragged and ungrounded simply by the nature of it, something like walking on quicksand all the time. So I was delighted when John, answering his knock on the door, brought him into the drawing room that evening after dinner. It was as a ray of sanity. 'How lovely to see you,' I cried, pulling up the hard-backed side chair he liked. 'We've been wondering so much about your meeting with Charles, if it ever transpired.' 'Thank you,' he said, taking the chair. 'I do hope I am not disturbing you, but I thought you might like to know how things went.' The meeting certainly did transpire. He was, as always, courteous and balanced. He was never effusive, never artificial in his manner. I remember noticing how gaunt and sallow he looked at that time. In the summer months his skin took on a beautiful golden warmth, but in the winter he looked pale. Now he looked ill. He had been a tall man in his youth, 6 foot, he had told me, but now was perhaps 3 or 4 inches shorter because of the tortures he had endured. He was powerfully built, however, and still had immense strength in his arms. I expressed concern for his health, but he shrugged it off, wanting to focus on the purpose of his visit. He explained that Charles had been unable to offer him employment, but instead had taken him to see Cecil Banks. He explained his reluctance to write a book about his life, but that he had reached the conclusion that perhaps he had no choice. Both John and I were delighted. The possibility of him writing a book had never occurred to either of us. It would have the desired effect, so we both thought, although for me it was not desired, of moving him out of the circle of our lives into the limelight, where he would be surrounded by people of note in the literary world. I felt a pang of uncertainty. Sensing or reading my thought, he said, "I shall never forget you. For me you will always be present. I have had little assistance in my life, you know, so I value it highly. Now I am going to leave you, but before I go I have promised my wife that I would deliver a message to you, Mrs. Rouse. She would like to invite you to tea, and wonders if you would have time for that." "Oh, but of course I would. How kind of her. Ask her to telephone me, won't you please, and we can arrange it." I was pleased with the invitation, and, as much as anything else, anxious to meet this woman who was the wife of such a remarkable man. From her voice on the telephone I knew she came from the North Country. Being a northerner myself, I am familiar with various accents, so I placed her in my mind as a Cumbrian and, as it turned out, I was quite correct. Later, I learned that she was born and brought up on a farm in Cumberland. It seemed her father had been abusive, regarding her as lazy, and she had been very unhappy. She had left home early and gone in for nursing. All this I found out much later, as I say. This first day she had asked me to meet her in a restaurant, or tea shop, in Kensington High Street, and said I would recognize her because she would be wearing a certain thing. I do not recall exactly what it was, but let us say a green scarf. When I arrived at the appointed time, the place was almost empty, three tables also being occupied. I quickly looked around and spotted her immediately. She got up, and spoke with the voice I knew. She had already ordered tea and cakes, and as soon as I was seated opposite her began to pour the tea with no further ado. She was talkative and friendly, clearly wishing to create a good impression, but actually making one feel slightly uncomfortable by the intensity of her manner. Despite that, I found her fascinating. She talked about such things as astrology, clairvoyance, telepathy in much the same way as I would have discussed a dance, the theater or a point-to-point. These exotic subjects were commonplace to her. She had obviously studied, she had intellectualized, but because it was not truly a part of her, not knowledge and ability she had been born with, she found it necessary to talk about it. Her husband, on the other hand, seldom talked about exotic subjects in everyday life. When he did, it was so deeply a part of him that it seemed entirely natural. He might have been discussing the weather. Later, when he wrote about metaphysics, occult and esoteric subjects, he found it boring and often said he hated writing. Despite that, he was always fully able, as any real teacher can, to simplify, explain, draw parallels. In metaphysical terms, he was an adept. So was she, then, this wife of his. Anything like I expected? No, perhaps not. In appearance she was plain, middle-aged and rather overweight. Her hair was white, straight and unattractively cut, short, severe and unbecoming. She wore spectacles and no makeup. Later, from the beautiful portrait photographs done by her first husband, Cyril Hoskins, which she kept on display, it was apparent that she had been striking in her youth, with excellent bone structure, a Nefertiti-type profile and black hair. But this kind of beauty requires money and leisure to maintain, and she had been granted neither. She lived, one has to say, with the memory, and this gave to her personality a narcissism which for the individual meeting her now was hard to understand. She had what I would call a strong character. Her belief in herself was firm, even if others failed sometimes to see it as she did. I wanted to know about the book, how the agent had liked the synopsis, if a publisher had been found. She was surprisingly noncommittal about it. Perhaps she was less than enthusiastic about a book and the prospect of fame for her husband. But I did learn that the agent had approved of the synopsis, and I supposed that when a publisher had been found, Dr. Kuhn would let us know, and indeed that was the case. In retrospect, it seems strange that I was not curious as to how they met. But the truth is just that. I already had respect for Dr. Kuhn in a way I had never before respected anyone. He was on a different level from anyone else I was ever likely to meet, and so, although I would have been keenly interested in the minutest details concerning anyone else I might have come across and liked, in his case it never occurred to me to pry or question. I trusted him utterly. I was prepared to accept his wife on the same level. But of course she in no way equaled him. It would be unfair to expect her to, and as my story unfolds you will see why. The sad part, I think, is that it was hard for her not to occupy the limelight he would have given anything to avoid. Cecil Banks was of the old school. He had set ideas about certain things, and he saw no reason to change. He had always managed very well the way he was. Writers and publishers were his bread and butter, and he knew which side his bread was buttered on. They came in different types, often tricky to deal with, but he had them classified in his mind and knew pretty well which to put with which and how they would react. It was like horse racing. He knew where to place his bets. When Dr. Guen arrived in his office, however, only 10 or 15 days after their first meeting, and complete with what looked like a reasonably full synopsis by the size of it, he was taken by surprise. A synopsis was not something you just did in a matter of days like that, not if it was any good. Maybe it was not any good. Maybe Charles was barking up the wrong tree and he had been taken in. He wished the llama would sit down instead of standing there, waiting. It was unnerving. Ah, well now, Dr. Guen, so you decided to do the book after all? Splendid, splendid, really splendid news. Do sit down, won't you? Rubbing his hands together, he was at his most affable in an effort to dissemble his astonishment. The llama remained standing. But, well, you realize of course that I may not have a chance to look at it for a week or two. Pressures, you know, pressures. Rest assured, though, I will deal with it and contact you. Now, do we have your telephone number? I have no telephone. More to the point, I have no food on the table. I also have pressures. The llama's voice was low, but his words cut like steel. His eyes were hard. There was no doubt that he meant what he was saying. I will return in 1 week, Mr. Banks. If you haven't had time or inclination to come to a decision in that time, I will ask for my work to be returned to me. Good afternoon. He made his usual slight bow before turning towards the door and closing it quietly as he left. Cecil was so startled he did not even ring for Miss Bartle to show the llama out. For a moment he sat there, then he reached for a cigar. What the devil? He had never had a client like this one. He was tempted to give the synopsis to Ms. Bartle and tell her to hand it to the llama when he returned next week, and that would be the end of it, but his better self made him hesitate. The man looked ill, perhaps he was starving, it would look bad if he dropped dead. He took the pages out of the large manila envelope and started to read. Half an hour later he rang for Miss Bartle. I don't want to be disturbed for the next hour. If anyone wants me, just tell them I am out for the rest of the day. An hour later he rang for her again. Get me through to Mr. W. Dash, will you? Please. And then, Fred, how are you? Cecil Banks here. How are you placed for luncheon this week? The day after tomorrow? Yes, excellent. Barclay Grill at 1 o'clock. I have something I think you'll like. He mixed a drink and stared out of the window. It was only a synopsis, but it got you, it moved you, it was like the llama himself, it took you to the unknown, it took you out of yourself. He hardly ventured to think what the book might be like. This kind of thing did not come along every day, in fact it was a rarity. It was compelling, it breathed life, it was genuine. He would take it home tonight, finish it, look at it again. But he hardly needed to. His experience told him all he wanted to know. Fred W. was one of the best in the publishing world, he only handled the best, his firm had a good reputation, had had for years, and he was no fool either. If he took it, and Cecil felt almost sure he would, well, they would have a winner. And he did take it. By the time, a few weeks later, Dr. Guen returned to tell us the news. He had met the publisher and they had signed a contract. It had been agreed that they would pay him an advance on royalties. And what is the title? I wanted to know, so excited I could barely contain my joy. Now they could eat better, they might move to a more comfortable place. I did not consider or realize the work he was having to undertake. The title will be The Third Eye. I shall write under a different name, Tuesday Lobsang Randpa, T. Lobsang Randpa. In fact, I'll probably change my name to Rampa legally. Easier that way, I think. So now we should call you Dr. Randpa, I suppose, John said, in a rather slighting voice. No, not at all. My friends call me Chen, he replied simply. Chen. What a lovely name and how well it suits you. We shall be honored to call you by that name, I told him warmly, hoping to mitigate any insult he might have inferred from my husband. and the name did suit him. He stayed only a short time that evening, and as he was leaving he turned and said, "The publisher wants me to bring him a chapter at a time within a certain time." With a wry smile he went on, "I'm a foreigner, after all, not always to be trusted, eh? Anyway, as I do the chapters, I'd like you to look them over, if that wouldn't be too much trouble." "Oh, but we'd simply love to do that, wouldn't we, John? We'd be delighted and honored," I told him. John nodded his agreement. "Of course we'd be pleased, but Sheila has more time than I do, naturally. Anyway, this is excellent news. I'm sure you'll write a first-class book." We were not directly responsible for the birth of this book. In reality, Charles occupied that position, but it is an undisputed fact that without us it would not have happened. Chapter 3. My mother was a Victorian. Born near the end of Victoria's reign, admittedly, but still a Victorian. She lived to an advanced age, her life spanning almost the entire 20th century. She was a remarkable woman and a difficult one, but she had some sound ideas, often unique to herself. She was sympathetic towards children and firmly held the belief that they should be surrounded by beautiful things from the earliest stage, the premise being that it would foster a sense and appreciation of beauty. If things were broken, finger-marked and generally messed up, no matter, it was all in a good cause. When I was small I loved to paint and draw, and to help the creative impulse along, and in keeping with my mother's philosophy, I was given a rather lovely antique walnut Davenport. It should really be Davenport, capital D, I think, because these particular little desks, or, more correctly, chest of drawers with a sloping desk top, were named after a Captain Davenport who, so I believe, had the first one made by the cabinet makers known as Gillow, to be installed in his cabin when he took to the high seas. I loved my Davenport and spent hours perched on a chair made especially for me, with longer legs than usual, giving life to my childish imagination with pencil and brush. I cannot help thinking of this as I sit in front of a rather nasty plastic computer, a wonder of the modern world, but soulless. Could it be that if I were sitting at my beautiful little walnut Davenport with pen in hand, I would see in my mind's eye the picture taking shape more clearly? Could it be that I would write with greater fluency and skill? It is more than possible. Could my mental picture be clearer? Could it be even more magical? But there is no point in wondering. The computer is here to stay. With my imaginary brush I wet the imaginary paper, and as I do so I travel back down the years through the storehouse of memories and attempt to put the events of my story in order, to make a coherent whole, and paint it as it happened so long ago. It was during the writing of The Third Eye that I came to know the ramp as well. Looking back it seems amazing that Chen was able to write a book of any sort in the cramped, noisy, disruptive conditions in which he and Rab lived, but then he was no ordinary man. He not only produced a book, he produced a classic of charm and beauty that lifted one from the mundane, was inspirational and comforting as well as being a delight to read. He put himself into that book so simply. It was an account of his early life, and it had depth and knowledge, it contained mystical, esoteric parts, and it was amusing and light in other parts. Tibet had been invaded by the British in 1904, and then by the Chinese in 1910, but by 1911 the invaders had been driven out, for the time being at least, and the Third Eye was set in a time of peace when the 13th Dalai Lama, the one whom many regard as the last true incarnation, was in control of the country. With two fingers and two thumbs, an old typewriter, a pillow at his back and sitting on the floor, Chen produced a small masterpiece, a book that would be translated into many different languages and sell worldwide, a book whose author would face criticism and scorn as well as adulation, but a book that would survive. Moreover, it still sells 50 years, or more, after its conception. Even the writing of it was not all plain sailing, yet he navigated the turbulence with dexterity. One also has to wonder about Trab's part in this. How could she tolerate the ghastly tap, tap, tapping, of a typewriter, and they were noisy things, day in and day out without going completely mad? How could she bear the neighbors rapping on the wall from next door, and the neighbors from below banging on their ceiling with a broom handle when they could take no more. But somehow she did, and she deserves credit. True to his word, he brought a chapter at a time for us to read. I am honestly not quite sure if it was a token of appreciation, or because he wanted to see the effect of his writing on the uninitiated. He was heard to remark quite often that his biggest problem was in knowing what it was that others did not know. He realized that things which were commonplace to him were often completely beyond the range of comprehension to most others, and with John and me he had a reasonable sounding board. I am reminded of the first day he arrived at our house with the opening chapter of The Third Eye in his hand. We lived in a quiet street just north of Kensington Gardens. A little further up the street stood an imposing synagogue which I assumed to be the Jewish equivalent of St. Margaret's, Westminster, the Anglican place of worship where smart society weddings, christenings, and any other cornerstone event of life took place on an impressive level for the sophisticated and wealthy. The synagogue was on the opposite side of the street from us, and the children loved to stand on the garden wall and watch the goings on through the black iron railings placed on top of the wall, with a running commentary from Jarvis causing acute embarrassment to Fenella. On this particular day we had just returned from a walk in the park, that is, Jarvis, Chester and myself. Fenella was at school. It was a chilly, brisk sort of day. Jarvis had been sailing his boat in the round pond and had dashed in after it, soaking his boots and woolen leggings, and even the bottom of his coat. I was annoyed with him, and annoyed with myself for letting it happen, and quickly bundled him into the pushchair I always took with us for just such an emergency, for the numerous times he fell off or into something, or for when he was just too tired to walk home. I strapped him in firmly and set off for home, irritated that Chester seemed unable to keep up when I was in a hurry to get home and change Jarvis into dry clothes before he caught cold. As we neared the house I could see an event was taking place at the synagogue. Large black cars were everywhere, exquisitely dressed women and men with top hats were alighting and crossing the street. They were in my way, and I needed to get home before my small son caught cold. I was impatient and annoyed. "Mama, Mama, look, look, it's a wedding," Jarvis strained at the belt keeping him in his pushchair. He wanted to get out and join in with what he saw, correctly, as a wedding. Black clothes for funerals, bright colors for weddings and christenings, that was what I had told them, and at least he had taken it in, although his habit of repeating everything twice was utterly maddening when one was already irritated. "Yes, darling, you're absolutely right, it must be a wedding," I agreed, "but let's get home and take off those wet things first, then you can stand on the wall and watch." I gave a tug at Chester's leash to make him hurry. He rewarded me with an extra and unnecessary lifting of his hind leg, making me feel mean and guilty. He really could not care less who was getting married or buried. He just wanted justice and a bit of consideration from this human to whom he was so loyal. So there was Jarvis, dry and wearing clean, warm shoes and socks, standing on the wall and supervising the elaborate nuptials of an eminent and wealthy member of the Jewish community, his commentary worthy of Richard Dimbleby, when who should come through the gate but Chen, with a large manila envelope in his hand. Jarvis jumped off the wall, and ran to my side. I knew he had reservations about Chen, but I was unclear as to what and why. "How wonderful to see you," I greeted Chen. "Can it be that you are bringing the first chapter? How did you guess?" "Yes, here it is. This is my copy, the publisher has his, and now we have to wait and see what he thinks." Turning to Jarvis he said, "Good day, Jarvis." The child did not answer, but clung to my skirt, burying his face in the fabric for all the world as though he were an ostrich in the sand. "Jarvis, it's poor manners not to reply when someone speaks to you," I rebuked him. He looked at me defiantly, and without a word let go of my skirt and ran through the partly opened gate, off down the street, dodging the unusual number of people on their way to the synagogue. He had not gone more than a few yards when he fell down, and I knew he had succumbed to an attack of asthma, My dreaded fear always that one day he would not survive, one day he would fall down and not get up. I started to go after him, but Chen put his hand on my arm. "No," he said, "let me go." I stood outside the gate watching as Chen made his slow and deliberate way to the small boy lying on the pavement. Why was he not running, I wondered, why did the people not stop to help? But they chose to ignore something unpleasant. They were on their way to an event, they were dressed in clothes unsuitable for dealing with illness. I might have reacted in exactly the same manner in their place. What could they do, anyway? All the same, at that moment I could have killed them, cheerfully. As he came level with Jarvis, Chen stood for a moment and regarded him lying on the ground, in a heap, fighting for breath. Then he knelt down beside him and touched his head, speaking to him. What an unlikely scene. The small boy on the ground, the man dressed in black kneeling beside him, the passers-by, decked out in their finery and intent on their function, in their own space. It was like two separate worlds interlocked but not touching. Then, as if by a miracle, Jarvis stopped gasping, his body became still, and slowly he rose to his feet and walked back towards me, his head down. "Mama, I'm sorry." He took hold of Chester's collar, and led him inside the house. What on earth could have happened in those brief few minutes to cause such a change in him? I looked to Chen for a clue, but received nothing. Casually referring to his book, he remarked, "I don't expect it will take you more than a day or two to read it. Would it be agreeable to you if I call in 3 days to see you, and get your reaction?" "Yes, yes, of course. We'll read it tonight after the children are in bed." "But, Chen, what happened, whatever happened with Jarvis?"
"Jarvis? Do you really want me to tell you?"
He paused, and then went on, "You overindulge him. He knows it, and he knows that I know it. That's why he doesn't want to have anything to do with me. Small children are often more aware of reality than adults. As they grow older, they get the ability stamped out of them by what is called reason. It's a pity really, but there is it." "I overindulge him? I don't follow. What has that to do with his asthma?" I was hurt but also genuinely puzzled. "Well, it's a psychological reaction, a sort of unconscious emotional blackmail. He won't have another attack."
"But what did you do?"
"Do you mean he's cured?"
"I don't understand."
"Don't try to understand. Don't try to reason it all out. Just accept it and one day you will understand. But as you are so curious, I will tell you one thing for your own good. Jarvis is overindulged, as I said, but you indulge him to indulge yourself. If you really want to help that child, you will loosen the ties that bind him to you. Think about it, I know what I'm talking about." He went towards the gate, then turned back. "Don't feel embarrassed to correct any mistakes in my grammar or spelling, will you?" And off he went, pulling the tall wooden gate shut behind him. That night John was out doing whatever it was he did that I was not privy to. I had ceased to think about it. The trouble was, though, that it was there between us and limited our conversation more or less to the weather. English weather, fortunately, is changeable and can be quite an extensive and inexhaustible topic. After the children were in bed, I took a tray, scrambled eggs, fruit and a glass of wine, to the drawing room where there was a good fire burning. The heavy gold curtains were drawn. I felt relaxed and comfortable. As I ate my supper, my mind ran over the day. It had been such a strange affair with Jarvis. The way he recovered. The way he said he was sorry. Sorry. He never said he was sorry except under pressure when he had been really naughty. I was reluctant to believe that he was cured, that some miracle cure had taken place. His illness has become such a bit noir with me, so ingrained that, although I dreaded it, I was unable to let it go. As for indulging Jarvis to please myself, well, that was ridiculous, complete and utter nonsense. I sipped the wine, a good one, satisfying, robust, and my eyes wandered to the pastel drawing of Fanella which hung over the mantelpiece. We had had it done a couple of years earlier, and I had never been too sure about it. There was something there that made me uneasy, although no one else seemed to notice it.
Now as I looked at the little girl over the rim of my glass, I knew suddenly what it was that troubled me. The child who stared back was unhappy, sulky, dissatisfied.